This is Audible.
From Simon & Schuster Audio, The Art of Happiness, by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Howard C. Cutler, M.D. Read by Howard Cutler with Ernest Abuba. Featuring His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
I think this is the first time I am meeting most of you. But to me, whether it is an old friend or a new friend, there's not much difference anyway, because I always believe we are the same. We are all human beings.
Moments before, I had found the Dalai Lama alone in an empty basketball locker room, waiting to address a crowd of 6,000 at Arizona State University. He was calmly sipping a cup of tea in perfect repose. But now he briskly rose and without hesitation left the room, emerging into the thick backstage throng of reporters, photographers, security personnel, and students. Finally, passing through a curtain, he walked on stage, bowed, folded his hands, and smiled. He was greeted with thunderous applause. At his request, the house lights were not dimmed, so he could clearly see his audience. And for several moments, he simply stood there, quietly surveying the audience with an unmistakable expression of warmth and goodwill. To those who had never seen the Dalai Lama before, his maroon and saffron monk's robes may have created an exotic impression. Yet his remarkable ability to establish rapport with his audience was quickly revealed as he sat down and began his talk.
Brothers and sisters, I am very, very happy to be here with you. And most of you, this is the first time I think a meeting. But to me, whether it's an old friend or a new friend, not much differences. I always believe we are the same human being. Of course, you see the different culture background and a different way of life, different how to say the faith or different color. But we are same. We are, I think, the human being on the combination of human body and the human mind. So therefore, our physical structure also same. Our mind and also the emotional level also same. So therefore, wherever I meet some, you see, some people, I always have the feeling that we are same. I'm just meeting one another human being, which just like myself.
I always have the feeling that I'm encountering another human being just like myself.
On that level,
I find it is much easier to communicate with others on that level. If we emphasize the specific characteristics, like I am Tibetan or I am Buddhist, then there are differences. But those things are secondary. If we can leave the differences aside, I think we can easily communicate, exchange ideas, and share experiences.
It was 1993. I had first met the Dalai Lama over a decade earlier while I was visiting Dharamsala, India, on a small research grant to study traditional Tibetan medicine. This beautiful and tranquil village, perched on a hillside in the foothills of the Himalayas, has been home of the Tibetan government in exile for almost 40 years. Ever since the Dalai Lama, along with 100,000 Tibetans, fled Tibet after the brutal invasion by Chinese forces. During my stay in Dharamsala, I had gotten to know several members of the Dalai Lama's family, and it was through them that my first meeting with him was arranged. Like so many other people, I came away from that first meeting in great spirits, with the impression that I had just met a truly exceptional man. As my contact with the Dalai Lama grew over the next several years, I gradually came to appreciate the many unique qualities of this man. He had a penetrating intelligence, but without artifice or cleverness, a kindness, but without excessive sentimentality, great humor, but without frivolousness, and the ability to inspire rather than awe. Over time, I became convinced that the Dalai Lama had learned how to live with a genuine sense of fulfillment and a degree of serenity that I had rarely encountered in other people. and I was determined to identify the principles that had enabled him to achieve this. I realized, of course, that many of his beliefs needed to be understood in the context of Buddhism, but I began to wonder if one could identify a set of his beliefs or practices that could be utilized by non-Buddhists as well, practices that could be applied to our lives to simply help us become happier, stronger, perhaps less afraid. With these thoughts in mind, I hoped someday to have the opportunity to discuss his views at length and to explore his approach to everyday living. Eventually, the Dalai Lama accepted persistent invitations to come to Arizona, where in addition to his lecture at Arizona State University, he gave an intensive 5-day public workshop which was held in a desert setting near Tucson. I arranged to meet with him for long private interviews during his stay in Arizona, and these discussions later continued at his home in Dharamsala. These public talks and private conversations became the basis for much of this book. While I had looked forward to our private conversations with great anticipation, I discovered that we had some initial hurdles to overcome as we struggled to reconcile our differences in perspective. His as a Buddhist monk, mine as a Western psychiatrist. I began one of our first sessions, for instance, by posing to him certain common human problems, illustrating with several specific case histories, and asking for his explanation and advice for dealing with these problems. I was taken aback when, after a long pause and reflection, he simply shrugged his shoulders, laughed good-naturedly, and said, "I don't know." When I pressed the issue and I said it was my job as a psychotherapist to find out why people do the things they do, he laughed again and said that since an individual human mind is so complex, one may never have a full explanation of why a person does the things they do, and at any rate, it would be extremely difficult to try to figure out how the minds of 5 billion different people work. Sensing my discomfort with his response, he explained further.
In trying to determine the source of one's problems, it seems that the Western approach differs in some respects from the Buddhist approach. Underlying all Western modes of analysis is a very strong rationalistic tendency and an assumption that everything can be accounted for. But in some instances, the basic premises and parameters set up by Western science can limit one's ability to deal with certain realities. For instance, you have the constraints of various fundamental premises, such as the idea that everything can be explained within the framework of a single lifetime, and you combine these with the notion that everything can and must be explained and accounted for. But this can cause problems when you come across some phenomena which you cannot account for. Then there's a kind of tension created. It's almost a feeling of agony.
I pointed out that in Western psychology, when we come across certain behaviors that on the surface are difficult to explain, we have certain approaches we can use, such as understanding the role of the unconscious or subconscious thought processes.
In Buddhism, there is the idea of dispositions and imprints left by certain types of experiences, which is parallel to the idea of the unconscious. For instance, a certain type of event may have occurred in an earlier part of your life which has left a very strong imprint on your mind, which can remain hidden and then later affect your behavior. I think that Buddhism can accept many of the factors that Western theorists can come up with, but on top of that, it would add additional factors. For example, it would add the conditioning and imprints from previous lives. In Western psychology, however, I think that there may be a tendency to overemphasize the role of the unconscious in looking for the source of one's problems. So when you can't explain what is causing certain behaviors or problems, the tendency is to always attribute it to the unconscious. It's a bit like you've lost something and you decide that the object is in this room. And once you have decided this, then you've already fixed your parameters. You've precluded the possibility of its being outside. So you keep on searching, but you are not finding it. Yet you continue to assume that it is hidden somewhere in the room.
While recognizing these differences between Eastern and Western outlooks, it soon became clear that the Dalai Lama does not feel that one has to adopt a Buddhist perspective when examining human problems. and by the end of our series of discussions, our cultural differences no longer seemed important as we explored the problems common to all human beings. When I initially conceived of the idea for this book, exploring the Dalai Lama's views, I envisioned a conventional self-help format in which the Dalai Lama would present clear and simple solutions to all of life's problems. Then, using my background in psychiatry, I could codify his views in a set of easy instructions on how to conduct one's daily life. But as our meetings progressed, I found that his approach was much broader and more subtle than I had imagined, incorporating all the nuance, richness, and complexity life has to offer. Gradually, however, I began to hear the single note he constantly sounded. It is one of hope. His hope is based on the belief that while attaining genuine and lasting happiness is not easy, it can be done. As his message unfolded, it became increasingly clear that his beliefs are not based on blind faith or religious dogma, but rather on sound reasoning and direct experience. His understanding of the human mind and behavior is based on a lifetime of study. His views are rooted in a tradition that dates back over 2,500 years, yet are tempered by common sense and a sophisticated understanding of modern problems. His appreciation of contemporary issues is the result of his unique position as a world figure, which has allowed him to travel the world many times, exposing him to many different cultures and people from all walks of life, and has enabled him to exchange ideas with top scientists and religious and political leaders. What finally emerges is a wise approach to dealing with human problems that is once optimistic and realistic. While omitting some discussions of the more philosophical aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, which can be found in a number of the Dalai Lama's other books, I have sought to present this unique and refreshing approach to a Western audience.
Part 1. The Purpose of Life. Chapter 1. The Right to Happiness.
I believe that the very purpose of our life is to seek happiness. That is clear. Whether one believes in religion or not, whether one believes in this religion or that religion, we are all seeking something better in life. So I think the very motion of our life is towards happiness.
With these words, spoken before a large audience in Arizona, the Dalai Lama cut to the heart of his message. But I wondered if lasting happiness, which in the West has always seemed so ill-defined, elusive, and ungraspable, was really a reasonable goal for most of us.
Yes. I believe that happiness can be achieved through training the mind. When I say training the mind in this context, I'm not referring to mind merely as one's cognitive ability or intellect. Rather, I'm using the term in the sense of the Tibetan word sem, which has a much broader meaning, closer to psyche or spirit. It includes intellect and feeling, heart and mind. By bringing about a certain inner discipline, we can undergo a genuine transformation of our attitude, our outlook, and approach to living. Now, when we speak of inner discipline, it can, of course, involve many things, many methods, but generally speaking, one begins by identifying the factors which lead to happiness and those factors which lead to suffering. Having done this, one then sets about gradually eliminating the factors which lead to suffering and cultivating those which lead to happiness. That is the way.
The purpose of our existence is to seek happiness. It seems like common sense, and Western thinkers from Aristotle to William James have agreed with this idea. But isn't a life based on seeking personal happiness self-centered, even self-indulgent? Not necessarily. Many surveys have shown that it is unhappy people who tend to be the most self-focused and are often socially withdrawn, brooding, and even antagonistic. Happy people, in contrast, are generally found to be more sociable, flexible, creative, and able to tolerate life's daily frustrations more easily. And most important, they are found to be more loving and forgiving than unhappy people. So scientific evidence, as well as our own experience, tells us that there is an intimate connection between personal happiness and kindness towards others. Our personal happiness needn't come at another's expense, as if somehow there were a finite quantity of happiness in the world. And the connection between personal happiness and kindness is reciprocal. Not only are happy people found to be more caring, but unhappy individuals who begin to consciously cultivate genuine compassion will find this a powerful antidote to their own problems. The Dalai Lama offers evidence of this in his own interactions with other people. In one conversation with him, I directly asked him if he was happy. He responded that he was. There was a quiet sincerity in his voice that left no doubt of this, a sincerity that was reflected in his expression and in his eyes. And throughout his week in Arizona, I often witness how his personal happiness manifested as a simple willingness to reach out to others, to create a feeling of affinity and goodwill, even in the briefest of encounters. One morning after his public lecture, he was walking along a patio on his way to his hotel room, surrounded by his usual retinue. He noticed one of the housekeeping staff standing by the elevators and paused to ask where she was from. For a moment, she appeared taken aback by this greeting from a foreign-looking man in maroon robes and seemed puzzled by the deference given him by the entourage. Then she smiled and answered shyly, "Mexico." He paused to chat with her for a few moments and then walked on, leaving her with a look of excitement and pleasure. The next morning at the same time, she appeared at the same spot with another of the housekeeping staff. The two of them greeted the Dalai Lama warmly as he got on the elevator, and he responded in turn. Every day after that, they were joined by a few more of the staff at the designated time and place, until by the end of the week there were dozens of maids, in their crisp gray and white uniforms, forming a receiving line that stretched along the length of the path to the elevators. So we begin then with the basic premise that not only is the purpose of our life to seek happiness, but in fact we can find it. It is a vision of happiness as a real objective, one that we can take positive steps towards achieving. And as we begin to identify the factors that lead to a happier life, we will learn how the search for happiness offers benefits not only for the individual, but for one's family and society at large as well.
Chapter 2: The Sources of Happiness.
Although it is possible to achieve happiness, happiness is not a simple thing. There are many levels. In Buddhism, for instance, there is a reference to the four factors of fulfillment: wealth, worldly satisfaction, spirituality, and enlightenment. Together, they embrace the totality of an individual's quest for happiness.
Studies have revealed what is most often borne out by our personal experience. Happiness is determined more by one's state of mind than external events. Success may result in a temporary feeling of elation, or tragedy may result in a period of depression, but sooner or later our overall level of happiness migrates back to a certain baseline. So, if we tend to return to our characteristic baseline level of happiness, no matter what our external conditions are, what determines this baseline? And more importantly, can it be modified, set at a higher level?
Let us leave aside for a moment ultimate religious or spiritual aspirations like perfection and enlightenment, and deal with joy and happiness as we understand them in an everyday or worldly sense. Within this context, there are certain key elements which we conventionally acknowledge as contributing to joy and happiness. For example, good health, the wealth that we accumulate, friendship or companions. We all recognize that in order to enjoy a fulfilled life, we need a circle of friends with whom we can relate emotionally and trust. Now, all these factors are, in fact, sources of happiness. But in order for an individual to be able to fully utilize them, your state of mind is key. It's crucial. If we utilize our favorable circumstances, such as our good health or wealth, in positive ways, in helping others, they can be contributory factors in achieving a happier life. And of course, we enjoy these things. But without the right mental attitude, without attention to the mental factor, these things have very little impact on our long-term feelings of happiness. For example, If you harbor hateful thoughts or intense anger somewhere deep down, then it ruins your health. Also, if one is mentally unhappy or frustrated, then physical comfort is not of much help. On the other hand, if you can maintain a calm, peaceful state of mind, then you can be a very happy person even if you have poor health, or even if you have wonderful possessions. When you are in an intense moment of anger or hatred, you feel like breaking them. At that moment, your possessions mean nothing. Today, there are societies that are very developed materially. Yet among them, there are many people who are not very happy. Just underneath the beautiful surface of affluence, there is a kind of mental unrest leading to frustration, unnecessary quarrels, reliance on drugs or alcohol, and in the worst case, suicide. So there is no guarantee that wealth alone can give you the joy or fulfillment you are seeking. The same can be said of your friends when you are in an intense state of anger or hatred. Even a very close friend appears to you as cold or distant. All of this indicates the tremendous influence that the mental state, the mind factor, has on one's experience of daily life. Naturally, then, we have to take that factor very seriously.
While social, material, and possibly even genetic factors may play a role in happiness, there is general agreement among modern behavioral scientists that whether we are feeling happy or unhappy at any given moment is largely determined by our outlook. Surveys and studies have shown that once our basic survival needs are met, our level of life satisfaction often has little to do with our absolute conditions, but rather with how we perceive our situation, how satisfied we are with what we have. And, as the Dalai Lama notes, our outlook can be modified by deliberately developing an inner compassion and serenity that is unaffected by changes in material circumstances.
So, leaving aside the perspective of spiritual practice, in terms of our enjoying a happy day-to-day existence, the greater the calmness of your mind, the greater your peace of mind, the greater your ability to enjoy a happy and joyful life. I should mention that when we speak of a calm state of mind or peace of mind, we shouldn't confuse that with a totally insensitive, apathetic state of mind. Having a calm or peaceful state of mind doesn't mean being totally spaced out or completely empty. Genuine peace of mind is rooted in affection and compassion. There is a very high level of sensitivity and feeling there. As long as there is a lack of the inner discipline which brings calmness of mind, no matter what external facilities you have, they will never give you the feeling of joy and happiness that you are seeking. On the other hand, if you possess this inner quality, a calmness of mind, a degree of stability within, then even if you lack various external facilities that you would normally consider necessary for happiness, it is still possible to live a happy and joyful life.
Though the Dalai Lama's words resonated with me, Western culture is to a considerable extent based on material acquisition, and our feelings of contentment are strongly influenced by a tendency to compare ourselves unfavorably with others and to continually long for more than we have.
I think there are two kinds of desire. Certain desires are positive. A desire for happiness, it's absolutely right. The desire for peace, the desire for a more harmonious world. Certain desires are very useful. But at some point, desires can become unreasonable. That usually leads to trouble. Now, for example, sometimes I visit supermarkets. I really love to see supermarkets because I can see so many beautiful things. So when I look at all these different articles, I develop a feeling of desire, and my initial impulse might be, oh, I want this, I want that. Then the second thought that arises, I ask myself, oh, do I really need this? The answer is usually no. If you follow after that initial impulse, then very soon your pockets will empty. However, the other level of desire based on one's essential needs for food, clothing, and shelter is something more reasonable. Now, a feeling of self-satisfaction alone cannot determine if a desire or action is positive or negative. A murderer may have a feeling of satisfaction at the time he is committing the murder, but that doesn't justify the act. All the non-virtuous actions, lying, stealing, sexual misconduct, and so on, are committed by people who may be feeling a sense of satisfaction at the time. The demarcation between positive and negative is not whether it gives you an immediate feeling of satisfaction, but whether it ultimately results in positive or negative consequences. For example, in the case of wanting more expensive possessions, if that is based on a mental attitude that just wants more and more, then eventually you'll reach a limit of what you can get. You'll come up against reality. And when you reach that limit, then you'll lose all hope, sink down into depression, and so on. That's one danger inherent in that type of desire. So I think that this kind of excessive desire leads to greed, an exaggerated form of desire based on over-expectation. And when you reflect on the excesses of greed, you'll find that it leads an individual to a feeling of frustration, disappointment, a lot of confusion, and a lot of problems. When it comes to dealing with greed, one thing which is quite characteristic is that although it arrives by the desire to obtain something, it is not satisfied by obtaining. Therefore, it becomes limitless, and that leads to trouble. The true antidote of greed is contentment. If you have a strong sense of contentment, it doesn't matter whether you obtain the object or not. Either way, you are still content.
So how can we achieve inner contentment? One method is to obtain everything that we desire. All the money, houses, cars, the perfect maid and the perfect body. The Dalai Lama has pointed out the disadvantage of this approach. Sooner or later, we will run up against something we can't have. The second and more reliable method is not to have what we want, but to want what we have. Each of us has the ability to make a conscious decision to limit the things that we want and to learn to acknowledge and appreciate what we already have. Another source of happiness closely linked with contentment is a sense of self-worth, and the Dalai Lama has very personal views on what we should base our sense of self-worth and how this helps one contend with upheaval and misfortune.
Now, in my case, suppose I had no depth of human feeling, no capacity for easily creating good friends. Without that, when I lost my own country, when my political authority in Tibet came to an end, becoming a refugee would have been very difficult. While I was in Tibet, there was a certain degree of respect given to the office of the Dalai Lama, and people related to me accordingly, regardless of whether they had true affection for me or not. But if that was the only basis of people's relation towards me, then when I lost my country, it would have been extremely difficult. But there is another source of worth and dignity from which you can relate to other fellow human beings. You can relate to them because you are still a human being within the human community. You share that bond, and that human bond is enough to give rise to a sense of worth and dignity and can become a source of consolation in the event that you lose everything else. Generally speaking, you can have two different types of individuals. On the one hand, you can have a wealthy, successful person. If that person's source of dignity and sense of worth is only material, then so long as his fortune remains, maybe that person can sustain a sense of security. But the moment the fortune wanes, the person will suffer because there is no other refuge. On the other hand, you can have another person enjoying similar economic status and financial success, but at the same time, that person is warm, affectionate, and has a feeling of compassion. Because that person has another source of worth, another source which gives him or her a sense of dignity, another anchor, there's less chance of that person becoming depressed if their fortune happens to disappear. Through this type of reasoning, you can see the very practical value of human warmth and affection in developing an inner sense of worth.
The Dalai Lama points out that self-satisfaction, immediate gratification, is not always a reliable indicator of whether desire is positive or negative. This is linked to his views on the nature of pleasure.
Now, sometimes people confuse happiness with pleasure. For example, not long ago I was speaking to an Indian audience at Rajpur. I mentioned that the purpose of life was happiness. So one member of the audience said that Rajneesh teaches that our happiest moment comes during sexual activity. So through sex, one can become the happiest. So he wanted to know what I thought of that idea. I answered that from my point of view, the highest happiness is when one reaches the stage of liberation, where there is no more suffering. That's genuine, lasting happiness. True happiness relates more to the mind and heart. Happiness that depends mainly on physical pleasure is unstable. One day it's there, the next day it may not be.
Every day we are faced with numerous decisions and choices, and try as we might, we often don't choose the thing that we know is good for us. This is related to the fact that the right choice is often the difficult one, the one that involves some sacrifice of our pleasure. Over the centuries, a legion of philosophers, theologians, psychologists, and researchers have struggled to define the role that pleasure should play in our lives. But none of us really need dead Greek philosophers, 19th century psychoanalysts, or 20th century scientists to understand pleasure. We know it when we feel it. The touch of a loved one, the luxury of a hot bath on a cold afternoon, the beauty of a sunset. But there is also pleasure in the frenetic rhapsody of a cocaine rush, the ecstasy of a heroin high, the revelry of an alcohol buzz, the bliss of unrestrained sexual excess, the exhilaration of a winning streak in Las Vegas. These are also very real pleasures that many in our society must come to terms with. Although there are no easy solutions to avoiding these destructive pleasures, we do have a place to begin. The simple reminder that what we are truly seeking in life is happiness. As the Dalai Lama points out, that is an unmistakable fact. If we approach our choices by keeping that in mind, it is easier to give up the things that are ultimately harmful to us, even if they bring momentary pleasure. Frame any decision by asking yourself, "Will it bring me happiness?" That simple question can be a powerful tool in helping us skillfully conduct all areas of our lives. Approaching our daily decisions and choices with this question in mind shifts the focus from what we are denying ourselves to what we are ultimately seeking, a stable and persistent happiness. With this perspective, it's easier to make the right choices because we are acting to give ourselves something, not denying or withholding from ourselves, an attitude of moving toward rather than moving away, an attitude of embracing life rather than rejecting it.
Chapter 3, Training the Mind for Happiness.
The first step in seeking happiness is learning.
The choices and perceptions that create or destroy our happiness are all a product of our mental state. Once our basic needs for food, clothing, and shelter are met, we are left with a simple premise. We don't need more money, we don't need success, greater fame, we don't need the perfect body or even the perfect mate. Right now, at this very moment, we have a mind, which is all the basic equipment we need to achieve complete happiness.
When we refer to mind or consciousness, there are many different varieties. thousands of different thoughts or different minds. Just like external conditions or objects, some things are very useful, some are very harmful, and some are neutral. When dealing with external matter, we try to identify which substances are helpful, so we can cultivate and use them. And those things which are harmful, we get rid of. Similarly, when dealing with various states of mind, we should take and nourish those which are helpful, and try to reduce those which are harmful and negative. So, we first have to learn how negative emotions and behaviors are harmful to us, and how positive emotions are helpful. Once you realize that, you become determined to cherish, develop, and increase those positive emotions no matter how difficult they are. There is a kind of spontaneous willingness from within. So through this process of learning, of analyzing which thoughts and emotions are beneficial and which are harmful, we gradually develop a firm determination to change feeling. Now the secret to my own happiness, my own good future, is within my own hands. I must not miss that opportunity. In Buddhism, the principle of causality is accepted as natural law. In dealing with reality, you have to take that law into account. So in the case of everyday experiences, if there are certain types of events which you do not desire, then the best method of ensuring that is to make sure that the causal conditions which normally give rise to that event no longer arise. Similarly, if you want a particular event or experience to occur, then the logical thing to do is to seek and accumulate the causes and conditions that would give rise to it. This is also the case with mental states and experiences. If we are seeking happiness, we need to clearly identify different mental states and make a distinction, classifying them according to whether they lead to happiness or not. Now, for instance, hatred, jealousy, anger are harmful. They destroy our mental happiness. Once you harbor feelings of hatred or ill feeling towards someone, once you yourself are filled by hatred or negative emotions, then other people appear to you as also hostile. So as a result, there is more fear, greater inhibition and hesitation, and a sense of insecurity. If you maintain a feeling of compassion, loving kindness, then something automatically opens your inner door. Through that, we can communicate much more easily with other people, and that feeling of warmth creates a kind of openness. It gives you a spirit of friendship. Then there's less need to hide things, and as a result, feelings of fear, self-doubt, and insecurity are automatically dispelled.
There was an appealing logic to the Dalai Lama's thoughts, but I wondered, if happiness was simply a matter of cultivating more positive mental states such as kindness and so on, why are so many people unhappy?
Bringing about a transformation in one's outlook, one's way of thinking, is not a simple matter. It requires the application of many different factors from different directions. One shouldn't have the notion that there's just one key, a secret, and if you can get that right, then everything will be okay. It is similar to taking proper care of the physical body. You need a variety of nutrients, not just one or two. In the same way, you need a variety of methods to deal with the varied and complex mental states, and change takes time. There are a lot of negative mental traits, so you need to address and counteract each one of these. That isn't easy. But I think that as time goes on, you can make positive changes. Every day, as soon as you get up, you can develop a sincere positive motivation, thinking, I will utilize this day in a more positive way. I should not waste this day. And then at night, before bed, check what you've done, asking yourself, did I utilize this day as I planned? If it went accordingly, then you should rejoice. If it went wrong, then regret what you did and critique the day. So through methods such as this, you can gradually strengthen the positive aspects of the mind. No matter what activity or practice we are pursuing, there isn't anything that isn't made easier through constant familiarity and training. Through training, we can change. We can transform ourselves.
Challenging as the Dalai Lama's prescriptions may sound, we are not only psychologically, but also physiologically designed to transform ourselves using just the methods he recommends. The systematic training of the mind, the cultivation of happiness, is possible because of the very structure and function of the brain. We are born with brains that are genetically hardwired with certain instinctual behavior patterns. We are predisposed mentally, emotionally, and physically to respond to our environment in ways that enable us to survive. These basic sets of instructions are encoded in countless innate nerve cell activation patterns. But the wiring in our brains is not static. It's not irrevocably fixed. Our brains are also adaptable. Neuroscientists have documented the fact that the brain can design new patterns, new combinations of nerve cells and neurotransmitters, the chemicals that transmit messages between nerve cells, in response to new input, new thoughts, and experiences. In fact, our brains are malleable, ever-changing, reconfiguring their wiring according to new thoughts and experiences. Scientists call the brain's inherent capacity to change plasticity, and this remarkable feature appears to be the physiological basis for the possibility of transforming our minds. By mobilizing our thoughts and practicing new ways of thinking, we can reshape our nerve cells and change the way our brains work. Mental retraining involves changes in understanding as well as emotional changes. Although it may be natural for us to want to avoid suffering, in a world of sweeping changes and conflicting values, it may be necessary to re-educate ourselves about our own capacities for goodness and compassion, to distinguish between what Buddhism calls wholesome and unwholesome actions, and to behave accordingly. This is all part of the process of inner discipline described by the Dalai Lama, a discipline that includes attention to personal ethics.
I think that ethical behavior is another feature of the kind of inner discipline that leads to happiness. Great spiritual teachers like Buddha advise us to perform wholesome actions and avoid indulging in unwholesome actions. Whether one's action is wholesome or unwholesome depends on whether that action or deed arises from a disciplined or undisciplined state of mind. A disciplined mind leads to happiness, and an undisciplined mind leads to suffering. And in fact, it is said that bringing about discipline within one's mind is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. When I speak of discipline, I'm referring to self-discipline, not discipline that's externally imposed on you by someone else. Also, I'm referring to discipline that's applied in order to overcome your negative qualities.
I wondered why, if wholesome behavior naturally leads to happiness, and all of us want happiness, why should we need so much learning, training, and discipline to engage in more wholesome behaviors?
Doing wholesome deeds may not come naturally. We have to consciously train towards it. Traditionally, it has been considered the responsibility of religion to prescribe what behaviors are wholesome and what are not. However, in today's society, religion has lost its prestige and influence to some degree. At the same time, no alternative, such as secular ethics, has come up to replace it. It is because of this I think we need to make some special effort and consciously work towards gaining that knowledge. Although I personally believe that our human nature is fundamentally gentle and compassionate, it is not enough. We must also develop an appreciation and awareness of that fact. And by changing how we perceive ourselves through learning and understanding, This can have a very real impact on how we interact with others and how we conduct our daily lives.
Since we are born with an innate desire to achieve happiness and avoid suffering, and that does not have to be learned, it still seemed to me that the path of achieving happiness should be a more spontaneous and natural process, not requiring such extensive education and sophisticated knowledge. The Dalai Lama responded to this issue.
The more sophisticated your level of education and knowledge about what truly leads to happiness and what causes suffering, the more effective you will be in achieving happiness. For example, in overcoming anger, although animals may experience anger, they cannot understand that anger is destructive. In the case of human beings, however, you have a kind of self-awareness which allows you to reflect and observe that when anger arises, it hurts you. Therefore, you can make a judgment that anger is destructive. You need to be able to make that inference. And you need other abilities, such as the abilities to judge the long-term and short-term consequences of your behavior and weigh the two. So in learning about how to eliminate the causes of suffering and achieve happiness, it is more complicated than, for instance, simply putting your hand in a fire and then being burned and just learning never to do it again. So it is because of these things that I think education and knowledge are crucial. One problem with our current society is that we have an attitude towards education, as if it is there simply to make you more clever, make you more ingenious. The most important use of knowledge and education is to help us understand the importance of engaging in more wholesome actions and bringing about discipline within our minds, to effect changes from within, to develop a good heart.
Chapter 4, Our Fundamental Nature.
We are made to seek happiness. And it is clear that feelings of love, affection, closeness, and compassion bring happiness.
The Dalai Lama's view that the purpose of human life is to seek happiness is closely linked to his belief that the fundamental nature of human beings is gentle and compassionate, that all beings possess an underlying state known in Buddhist philosophy as Buddha nature, a state in which the mind is completely untainted by the negative emotions and thoughts that are the source of our suffering.
I believe that every one of us has the basis to be happy, to access the warm and compassionate states of mind that bring happiness. In fact, it is one of my fundamental beliefs that not only do we inherently possess the potential for compassion, but that the basic or underlying nature of human beings is gentleness. Now, the Buddhist doctrine of Buddha nature provides some grounds for the belief that the fundamental nature of all sentient beings is essentially gentle and not aggressive. But there are also other grounds on which I base this belief. I think the subject of human affection or compassion isn't just a religious matter. It's an indispensable factor in our day-to-day life. So first, if we look at the very pattern of our existence from an early age until our death, we can see the way in which we are nurtured by others' affection. It begins at birth. Our very first act after birth is to suck our mother's or someone else's milk. That is an act of affection, of compassion. Without that act of mutual affection, that bond, we cannot survive. That's clear. Then our physical structure seems to be more suited to feelings of love and compassion. We can see how a calm, affectionate, wholesome state of mind has beneficial effects on one's health and physical well-being, while negative states of mind, such as anger and hatred, are destructive to our health. We can also see that our emotional health is enhanced by feelings of affection. To understand this, we need only reflect